Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Political intimacy is closely related to personal intimacy, just as social change is related to personal change. In 1997, Bettina Aptecker, the author of Tapestries of Life, Women's Work, Women's Consciousness, and the Meaning of Daily Experience, was a professor of women's studies at the University of California at Santa Cruz, and a person who is clear and open about identifying herself as a lesbian. When we spoke in February of 1997, we explored the relationship of personal intimacy and political intimacy.
Idea of that, the way in which we got the idea, we in the women's movement politicized intimacy, was our understandings that came from women sharing experiences with each other that had taken place in their families and in relationships with men, in which they had experienced a good deal of physical, sexual, or emotional abuse. And as a consequence of that, it used to be that a woman might think that she personally was responsible for having provoked the situation, or that rape was a consequence of inappropriate action or presence on her part. But as women shared experiences with each other, they saw a pattern in which these experiences really had to do with the kind of power that men exercised in society. And from this developed our slogan, you might say, that the personal is political. It was meant to say that even in what we think of conventionally as personal relationships, they are informed by political conditions that exist, in which men have generally greater power in society than women do.
Well, what was it about the circumstances of the mid and late 60s and the 70s that allowed this consciousness to surface?
I think that the real origins of this could be told in different ways by different women based on their experiences. But I think for many of us who were involved in the student movement in the 60s, the late 60s, we were in the civil rights movement first, and of course African-American women were very prominent in that struggle, in the South especially, and we were involved in the movement against the war in Vietnam. And we were becoming quite politically aware, and when you do, you know, political analysis and you think about what are the causes of war or what are the causes of segregation and so forth, why weren't black people given the right to vote, etc., you begin to look at the power relationships that exist in a society and you begin to think about paradigms of domination. And I think that's what happened, and some of the women began to see that this also was impacting their personal lives. They were talking to each other, and in talking with each other and having conversations that were both personally and politically informed, I think women began to change the way in which they were seeing their personal situation. I also know factually and historically that a group of women, a couple of women in SNCC, that's the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, actually drafted a statement about the position of women in SNCC in the late 60s that was very, very important in the New Left.
What role do you feel that the birth control pill had on women taking a stronger and more active position?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Of course, once that pill became available in a certain kind of way, it also meant that you could have sexual connection without the necessary consequences of pregnancy. Of course, it didn't always work, and you had other contraception that was also available to women. But this coincides with a real sweep of what we used to call the sexual revolution, and allowing women much greater assertiveness in their relationships with men. But it's also an interesting thing that because the politics of sexuality had not yet been really clearly defined, I think that many women also experienced the sexual revolution as not being quite as liberating as one might think at first glance.
Well, it also became an opportunity for leaders like yourself at that time to begin to set standards or examples which would be the first status or the first standard to which subsequent ones were compared to.
I'm trying to think about what you mean in terms of leaders like myself. You mean?
Well, you were an outspoken woman.
Yes.
Are and were about ideas that needed to be brought to the forefront that previously weren't said.
Yes.
So now, well into a generation later, the earlier statements that were made by you and others became the basis. Subsequent statements were compared and are compared to what you said then. So my question is, beyond the statement that was formulated by the women of SNCC in the late 60s, were there other specific statements of that era? I mean, we can go back to the statements of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Matilda Joslyn Gage and Susan B. Anthony, but that's nearly 100 years earlier.
Right. I see what you're getting at, yes. Well, I think you can look at the eloquence of many of the women that came forward in that early period. I have to say that I was a reluctant feminist, and this was very much connected to my sexuality and my being in the closet as a lesbian, although I was married. I was somebody who came to the women's liberation movement 10 years after it had started, or at least, let's say, 8 years after it had started, because of that, which I can talk about more if you want me to. But I would say that some of the women like Gloria Steinem and Bella Abzug and Shirley Chisholm and Robin Morgan, for example, were women who gave tremendous power to the early stages of the women's liberation movement and spoke eloquently about the position of women in society.
Are you saying that your reluctance was related primarily to your lesbianism, or were there other factors?
I would say it was primarily related to my, to both. To my lesbian identity, because I knew that somehow this feminism was connected to my sexuality. You know, I knew there was some kind of connection, although I wasn't clear enough yet to understand what it was. But I knew that homophobia in the society was in some way connected to the oppression of women. And I was very, very reluctant to embrace my lesbian identity, although I knew of it from my teenage years.
What age were you when you were willing to publicly embrace your identity?
I was about 30.
What changed?
I think what changed for me was that there was a visible lesbian and gay community that had established itself from 1969 forward, after the incident in Stonewall, that usually marks the beginning of gay and lesbian pride. And I saw that there were many, many people who were gay and lesbian and trying to live their lives, and I read a lot of their stories and material that they had, often resonating with my own experience, and that was very liberating for me. Going to concerts where openly lesbian singers were performing, like Chris Williams and Holly Near, for example, in that early period, really, really empowering for me, and to see other lesbians around me. And at that time, I was wanting to leave my marriage, which I thought was not very good, and I wasn't wanting to leave it because I was a lesbian. I was wanting to leave it because it wasn't a good marriage. And I had 2 children, and I was really trying to think about what I wanted to do. And I think the other factor that was really important for me was that a very close friend of mine died about a year before. She was older than I was, but not that much older. And she died of cancer. And I really saw that my life was finite. I really saw that I didn't have forever to make choices in terms of my life dreams. So I just decided that I needed to get on with it. I needed to do it in order to really be a happy person.
In your experience, why do you believe there's such a high level of homophobia in our Western civilization, since in some other cultures it isn't so high?
Yes, it's very, very high. Well, you know, there's different, one can have different theories and ideas about this. I think it has to do with the level of patriarchy in the society, which really prohibits men from developing certain kind of intimacies with each other. It's tragic to me that you see that the major way in which men can express physical intimacy with each other, there's like two places where it's acceptable. One is in warfare, and the other is in football. Otherwise, there's a sense of a certain kind of definitions of masculinity, which really have to do with not only masking emotions, but masking connection, and especially with men.
Do you have a sense of why that history has evolved in the way you characterize it?
Well, the other part of it has to do then with wanting to subordinate women. You know, that's part of patriarchy. The definition of it is the idea that men establish social or political relationships for the purpose of subordinating women. And one of the ways that you subordinate women is that you make sure that they are economically, emotionally, politically dependent upon men. And you do that by enforcing a really tremendous ideological investment in romantic love between women and men, and in making a very strong taboo against intimacy between women. And that intimacy is okay. You can have intimacy among women as long as there are men, as long as the women are married, you know, as long as they have marriage. But as soon as you have a lesbian connection, where women are intimate with each other and are independent of men, it carries, I think, the potential, if not, it's not necessarily realized, but it carries the potential of women acting autonomously and independent of men. So that's why I think there is such a high level of homophobia. I think it's both ways. I think it's enforcing certain taboos among men and enforcing the subordination of women.
There's a body of literature that says that homosexuality among men is a genetic-based difference. Mm. Do you feel that applies to women?
I do not know what are the causes of lesbian identity. I have various ideas about what it might be, but I don't think anybody knows. And I think that any kind of idea... this is my personal idea about this. I think anything that ends up being a kind of biological destiny is wrong. I think that, and I include genetics in that, a human being is both biological and social. That's our nature, and you can't separate out one biological factor from all the social factors that end up comprising a human being and the social and the emotional and psychological factors that go into making a human being. So no, I don't hold much with the idea that this is a genetic issue.
I want to take a moment and say that my guest this week is Professor Bettina Aptecker, who wrote a very interesting book called Tapestries of Life. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Bettina, tell us about your relationship with your mother and her attitude towards your lesbian identity.
Oh, yes. There's a section of the book that you just mentioned in which the chapter is called Lesbian Connection. And the chapter opens with a description of coming out to my mother. Now, anyone who is a lesbian or gay will no doubt identify with the many stories that we have told each other about coming out to our families. Coming out stories can be hysterically funny, and they can also be very tragic. And, of course, the taboos are so great that sometimes in the society people are cut off from their families. Women have lost custody of their children for being lesbian and so on. In my particular case, I had been very reluctant to disclose my sexual identity to my parents. I'd always tried to be a very good daughter, done the right thing and so forth in my life. I'm sure many women can identify with that. And I've been living with my lover, whose name is Kate Miller, and we've been together now for 17 years. And at the time I came out, I think we'd been together probably, something like 8 years. And, you know, she'd been We'd been raising our children together, and she'd been to my parents' home countless times, but I'd never actually had a conversation with them, and I really had no idea whether they knew or not. And so I was very nervous about them knowing. And then at one point, my son, who was then a teenager, was visiting his grandmother, who's my mother, and inadvertently told her, he sort of blurted out, that I was a lesbian. Then he was very shy about this afterwards because the children had been quite supportive of us and had sort of protected us. And he came home and told me that he had told my mother this, so it was clear to me that the next time I saw my mother, I was going to have to come out to her. And what I thought was so terrifically funny about it in the moment was that when I did, she was not in the least bit surprised, and she said to me, "I've known since you were 16. And I said to her, "Why didn't you tell me?" And she said, "Because she hopes for the best." So she also had internalized all of this homophobia. She also loved me. And she continued to be extremely supportive of myself and my lover and our family, even despite her own taboos. In other words, she had all the confusions about it, but she saw us as being a very healthy couple, and she saw that the children thrived in our family. So I think she was quite good.
Well, by figuring simple arithmetic, you were in your early 40s about that when you came out
That's
to your
right.
parents.
Yeah.
When did you realize that you are a lesbian person?
Well, I knew it from the time I was about 15, I would guess. I think I was about 15. I didn't have the word. I didn't know the word lesbian, but I knew that my primary attractions were to women, and they were both emotional and sexual. So it was as I came into adolescence.
And obviously your mother knew it since you were 16.
Exactly, which I find so ironic, just amazingly ironic.
So why then is that secret kept for those 25 years?
Yes. Why was the secret kept?
Or was it not discussed between mother and daughter? A supportive mother and a forceful young woman,
yes.
The daughter.
Well, I suppressed it because I had definitely internalized the idea that lesbian was perverted. There's no doubt in my mind about that. Now, the other thing I think that's really important in my personal history here that might be helpful to understand is that I was raised in a communist family. My mother and father were both very prominent members of the Communist Party.
And your father was a well-known author.
Yes, very well-known author in African-American history and a well-known communist. In the 1950s, he was frequently called before all those McCarthy committees. I'm sure you remember them.
Sure.
And so he was on television, and he was testifying in various trials and so forth. He himself was never prosecuted. But the pressure was very great to be very good. And the other thing that
by
I...
Good, by very good, what do you mean?
Obedient, conforming to my parents' wishes, conforming to their political views, causing as little upset as possible.
Can you, Bettina, can you be specific as to what their wishes and their political views were to which they wanted you to conform?
Well, it would be, for example, I thinking about this, you know, I didn't discover Winnie the Pooh until I was an adult, because when I was a little kid, the kinds of books that were available had to do with even children's books, you know, with building socialism. And with anti-fascist struggles in Europe. And I was reading Marx probably by the time I was 10 or 11. So that's the kind of, you know, the kind of environment. Very, very intellectually stimulating. I had the privilege, for example, of knowing Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois as a child, one of the great leaders of the black movement in this country. But I also did not have anything resembling a traditional childhood. So what I was getting at in terms of the lesbian that I wanted, this little story I wanted to say here, was that I learned as an adult that in the 50s, the Communist Party either asked people to resign or expelled people from the party who had ever had homosexual connections. And I did not know this consciously until I was an adult and a member of the party told me this story. but I must have known it as a child, the kind of thing that a child might erase from conscious memory. This was a terrible witch hunt that was perpetrated by communists themselves because they were so worried about people who might have had a lesbian or gay relationship being persecuted by the FBI.
Which is kind of ironic considering J. Edgar Hoover's
stunning. It's almost stunning in its historical irony. But that's exactly right. And so I think that for me, no, I think I must have known that as a child, and so I suppressed any possibility of being a lesbian because of that.
So when your mother says she didn't tell you when she recognized it when you were about 16 because she hoped for the best, how does that fit in to how you see yourself now or your relationship with your mother?
Well, I at the time, it just flooded me with compassion. And it actually helped me to think about why she had such a strong taboo herself. Because in that initial conversation, after she said that to me, she also said that she had known lesbians and that they had had very hard lives. And she also talked to me about many women friends who were very important to her.
And she didn't want you as her child to have a hard life.
Exactly. That's exactly where it came from. So rather than seeing the possibility of challenge, because she didn't have any framework in which to think about the politics of why lesbians were suppressed. You know, she didn't have any kind of framework like that. So from her point of view, she's trying to protect her child.
Bettina, I'm curious about the level of spirituality that existed in your home life as this intellectually active and politically active atmosphere where you grew up.
I would say that in general we were bereft of any kind of spiritual life. Even in non-religious terms, you know, institutional religion. I would say, although there's an interesting irony about that also, but what I'd say about that is, of course, we were Jewish, and we celebrated none of the Jewish holidays except Passover, and that was when we were invited to members of our extended family who might have seders. Never went to synagogue. I had very little, if any, Jewish education as a child. So that part of a spiritual or religious background was mostly, the Jewish identity was mostly in terms of speaking about the Holocaust and the effects that that had on people. My father was in World War II in the European theater, and it had a very profound effect on him. So there was a lot of conversations like that, but there was no real spiritual life unless you consider the idea of the communist movement as a kind of materialist spirituality. In other words, that for my parents, their passion about socialism would be the kind of passion that many people might develop around spirituality.
I sense from what we've talked about that your spirituality is slightly different.
Yes.
Can you give us a sense of what it is in a minute or two or three? That's probably a lot to say in a short time.
Well, that's really true, and I'm terribly grateful for it. I feel very, very grateful. One thing I can say is that I did, and I have made an effort to reclaim my Jewish heritage, and a member of my temple and the community in which I live, and enjoy services very, very much. Have great respect for Jewish feminist work that's being done, and have tried to embrace that part of who I am. The other spirituality that has been extremely important to me has been influenced by Tibetan Buddhism and by Native American philosophy, and which they bear great similarity to each other in certain kinds of ways. And this has to do with really seeing the interconnection of all of life.
Why do you think that there is a special connection that Jewish people have to social justice?
I think the roots of that go back to the Holocaust. I think that for at least the Jewish people of my generation, we were born in the late middle to late 40s. We were raised in the shadow of the Holocaust. There's hardly a Jewish family in this country that was not in some way affected by it, sometimes with directly with relatives being killed, others by stories and so forth. That we had, at least some of us had, an understanding of the terrible consequences of racism when it is not always and ferociously challenged. And I think, for example, back to the 60s, that the two of the three young men killed in Mississippi in 1964, there was James Cheney, who was African-American, and then Goodman and Schwerner, and they were, of course, young Jewish men who had gone to Mississippi to help with the voter registration work. And I think that for my generation, it is the consequences of the Holocaust that propelled us into movements for social justice.
Well, Bettina Aptecker, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious, but before we leave, I'd like to ask you the question I ask all of my guests, and that is, could you please tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
An interesting book? Well, that's wonderful, since I'm immersed in teaching a class on women's culture right now, and one of the most wonderful books I just read is called Ceremony. It's a novel by Leslie Marmon Silko, and it was published in the late 70s, and I think it stands as a great piece of American literature.
Can you give us a little summary of it?
Yes. It's a story of a Native American Navajo young man whose name is Teo, who is a veteran of World War II. And he comes back to the reservation, to the impoverishment of his people, and he has been completely shattered by the war and by his experiences in the war. And the book is the story of his healing. And the instrument of his healing is the spiritual appearance of Thought Woman, who is the creator in the Navajo tradition of all of life.
Well, Bettina Aptecker, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you very much for having me.
Bettina Aptecker is the author of Tapestries of Life, Women's Work, Women's Consciousness, and the Meaning of Daily Experience. The book that she recommends is Ceremony by Leslie Marmon Silko. There are over 500 archive editions of Radio Curious on our website, www.radiocurious.org, where they're free for you to stream, download, enjoy, and share. We appreciate your curiosity, ideas, comments, and questions. You may reach us by email. Our address is curious@radiocurious.org or snailmail 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California 95482, or by phone 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. Christina Onnestad is our associate producer, and I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.